In the lives of Native Americans, we all have one thing in common: bloodlines. The bloodlines are what connect our past to our future. In this podcast, we talk with Indigenous women who are impacting their world for the better, in big ways and small ways, while never forgetting to go back to their roots. Join Jeannie Burgess, member of the Peoria Tribe of Oklahoma, as she has conversations with powerful Native American women who are making a difference in their neighborhood, communities, and their world. Please subscribe and share and review our podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone. Welcome, Bloodlines. I say how excited I am really with every person that comes on, but it's really true. I really am so excited to talk to this group of women over this season of this podcast. And I'm more than happy to be welcoming Marla Noni. And Marla, I just want you to tell me about yourself and the tribes, because it's more than one that you're from. Just tell us what you want the audience to know.
Okay. My name is Marla Noni. I'm from Cache, Oklahoma, which is in Southwest Oklahoma and near Comanche country, what it is now nowadays. But my tribes are Comanche, Seneca, and here on Band Potawatomi. And I'm actually enrolled with the Seneca Nation of Indians here in New York, which is where I'm currently calling from. But I just am so thankful to be a part of this podcast. And I want to commend you all for doing some project like this. It's one of those that sets a standard, I think, in really looking at what women, especially Indigenous women, are doing live in person, as opposed to what we see on TV. You know, these are everyday women that we're hearing about, you know, and I think that in our time of just being with technology has really increased those chances to be able to showcase what all we do as Indigenous women. But getting back to where I'm from and the tribes that I'm a part of is, you know, growing up in Oklahoma, there's 39 tribes there just within the state. And it's very unique. And every tribal nation has their own ways and cultures about them. I can remember, even though I'm half Comanche, I can remember those times of growing up and just really every other brown person that you see, you just naturally think, well, that's my cousin, or you know, we're all from the same group. And, you know, it wasn't until later in life, at, you know, in college, you start to see, well, we're from Oklahoma too, and they're a different tribe, and well, I'm from Oklahoma too. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, where are you guys from? I've never seen you. But it's one of those that we can all share and learn from each other. And that's what makes podcasts like this so important, is that the younger generations can hear from us, you know, and those that have kind of, we're having to bridge the gap, if you will. And that's a lot of why I still sing Comanche hymns. I'm a Comanche recording artist. And I say Comanche because my family is a family of Comanche songs. They are composers of those Comanche songs that have been passed down through the generations. And it was back in 2000 that I really, you know, you have like this life-changing moment that is like the snap of a finger, And you realize that, wow, you know, I am from a strong family. I'm from a beautiful place. And I want to share this with the world. And so it was then that I really started to set out on that journey. It was more for a spiritual journey, personal journey, spiritual in the sense of trying to renew my spirit because it had been broken. It basically was broken from a life-changing event that was where I was held up at gunpoint in Tulsa. And, you know, it wasn't like I was in the bad part of town or anything like that. It was on the good side of town. And people were like, well, that doesn't happen on this side of town, 71st Memorial. And I'm like, well, it happened to me. And so basically I got held up at gunpoint. And what happened was me being who I am, my laughter is what I'm known for. I laugh all the time. And it's just one of those signature, I don't know.
Yeah, I laugh a lot. Thing. No, I totally understand that because I'm a right? laugher too. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Good. So it's one of those things that people will say, I heard this yeah. laugh. I know that laugh.
Right.
You know, it's one of those type yeah. of laughs that is signature to you. But what I found was after that life-changing event, I wasn't talking to anybody and I wasn't looking yeah. at anybody. I wasn't even grocery shopping was like only done at lunchtime.
Yeah, it was the trauma.
Yeah.
You had been through trauma.
I didn't realize that. I was, I graduated in 2000 from OU and I went to work in Tulsa. And what happened was a month of me living there, working there, I got held up. And once the two gentlemen put a gun to my head and actually blew the gun, fired it off by the flip of a wrist and hearing the shell fall behind me, I was just like, wait a minute, this is, what do you want? If you want my car, go ahead and take it. It's right there. Mm-hmm. Material things don't matter to me in that regard. It's right. When it's not so much that it's a life or death situation, but it's just like, it's just material. It can be replaced. And so they jumped in my car and they took off. Well, I was working in Tulsa for Red Man Pipe and Supply during mm-hmm. that time in their corporate office. And that company, such a great company, and just the history there was just really something to look forward to. I was really blessed that I was able to land something like that. So when I went to work there and this event happened, I come off the elevator like, wow, I cannot believe this happened. I walk to work. Whenever I got held up, they fired the gun, they jumped in the car and then they took off. Well, I called the police. And of all times, it was like, I couldn't get a hold of anybody.
Right.
And I was
right.
just like, call my mom, call my dad, call, so-and-so.
Yeah.
No one would answer. And so finally that was like July. It was July 13th, 2000. And so it was right after, right in rush hour, 71st Memorial, 5:30 p.m. And I was at the car wash. And so whenever that happened, I'm like, wow, there's all these vehicles. Like, no one's stopping. Like, what in the world? So I called, called the 911 and police come. And they said, well, we got to get a hold of somebody. And I'm like, I know. Where am I going to go? And so we finally were able to get in touch with someone. I had my dad call a friend and
right.
he called his daughter to come pick me up. And so Jennifer Naya is my friend who came and picked me up. And she said, well, you can stay at my place you know, until you feel safe. And I said, well, great, that's wonderful. And I said, but, you know, I need to go back to my apartment whenever I got to go to work so that I can get ready and go to work. And she said, okay. So, you know, we went back to her apartment and we're sleeping, her and her little son. And I just thought, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, I would use my car to go home and help take care of my mom and my brothers. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, we'll just do what we can. You know, if I can make it, great. If not, you know,
sure,
it's fine.
Sure.
So basically, my mom, you know, I called, was able to get in touch with her. And it was like, oh my gosh, my baby. She's she's stranded up there. You know, I knew you shouldn't have moved to the city. And I was just like, Mom, no, it's okay. You know, it's okay. I'm okay. No worry. And so whenever I went to work and I come off the elevator on the 8th floor, and I'm just like, you are not going to believe what happened to me. And so I was telling the secretary what happened. And I told her I got held up after work and that they had my car still. And then she said, well, okay, but how did you get to work? And I said, well, I had my friend come get me. And she basically got me to my apartment. Then I got ready and came to work. And she goes, well, where's your car? And I said, well, that's the other thing. Okay, so they found the car. They found one of the guys that had the one that pulled the trigger. And they found the car with, he was with his girlfriend in my car. And so whenever we went to go retrieve it, you know, it was in the middle of the night. It was like 1:30 in the morning. And I said, you know, I just want my car. And then we can just forget it all about all this. You know, I'm okay.
Oh, you did?
I just need to get my car. And, you know, we can just forget about all this. And they said, well, Marla, it doesn't quite work.
I don't think it works that way, does it?
No. And I said, okay. I said, well, what do you need me to do? And he goes, well, Marla, we need you to identify this guy. And it's 1:30 in the morning. Okay. They put him, I'm in the car, my friend, I'm in the back seat, my friend's driving. And they said, we're going to put him in the car lights of the vehicle in front so you can see him. He won't be able to see you, but you'll be able to see him.
Right.
And I said, okay. All right. Look. And they're like, Marla, this is the guy. And I'm like, I'm not sure. I want to be positive because I can't just say that's the guy and not be sure.
Yeah. And it'll change his whole life if it wasn't the guy.
Yes. He goes, Marla, I'm going to ask you, is this the guy? And I said, I'm not for sure. And he goes, Marla, this is the guy that fits your description. He's the one that we found in the car. He's the one. All we have to have you do is say yes.
Yes.
And I said, I want to be sure, though, because so many times we see people get locked up and it's wrongful. Yeah, and it's just like, what? And he goes, Marla, I'm going to ask you, is this the guy? And I said, I'm sorry, sir. I'm not for sure. I want to be sure. And he goes, okay, Marla. And you could tell
he was frustrated with you.
He was getting frustrated. He said, all right, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to ask you one more time. And if you say no, or if you say I'm not sure, we're going to have to let him go. And I said, okay, I understand. He goes, is this the guy that pulled the gun on you? Sir, I'm sorry, I'm not for sure. He goes, let him go. They let him go. He took off running. And I said, I just want my car. That's all I want. I just want my car. Let's just forget about all this. He goes, no, it doesn't work like that. Because the car's not even in your name. It's in your dad's name. And I was like, so I can't get the car? He goes, well, we still have to run fingerprints. I said, okay. So he calls fingerprint guy. He comes over. By that time, it's like 4:30 in the morning. Fingerprint guy starts to do his fingerprints. And he goes, well, There's dew on the car. We can't even get any fingerprints. And I said, great. So we can just give me the car and then I can go to work, right? Or go back home. And they said, no, it's not your car. This car is in your dad's name, right? And I said, yeah. He goes, we haven't been able to get in touch with your dad, right? And I said, okay, I hear you. So what do we need to do? Well, we got to wait till we hear from your dad. I said, okay. And he goes, we'll try to get this report done and be, you know, go on about our way. And I said, okay. And I said, so, you know, after time passes, of course, you know, I'll get the approval that dad called and was able to get in the car and I go to work, right? So that's whenever I'm coming off the elevator. And by that time, I'm a zombie, you know. And I come off the elevator and I said, you're not going to believe what happened. And I just like plumped down on the sofa chair that's in the waiting area. And she goes, Marla, what is wrong? And I said, no, you're not going to believe what's going to happen. What happened to me last night, but what's going to happen today? And she goes, what do you mean? And she goes, you look serious. And I said, I am serious. And so I said, I need to talk to my boss. And she goes, okay, well, I'll get him on the phone and get him up here. And I said, there's going to be a detective that comes by and he's going to ask for me. And we're going to have to go through pictures to identify the people that stole my car. And she goes, what? Stole your car? And so I told her, you know, what all had happened. And my boss comes up by that time and he goes, Marla, come on, let's go to my office. And so we're talking and I tell him what all happened. And, you know, naturally everyone's blown away. And he goes, well, you know what, Marla? He goes, we have a bunch of resources. Whatever you need, we're here. You know, don't feel like you're all alone in this.
Right.
Well, I just think I just need to work myself out. You know, just put myself in overdrive and we'll get back to par and everything like that. Well, what I didn't realize at that time, I mean, because I'm in my 20s, you know, and I didn't realize that you put yourself in overdrive, that's not really a safe way to handle things.
No, no.
And I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
And so what happened was I closed myself in. And wasn't, if I went grocery shopping, it was only during lunchtime. And I would work from like 7 to 6 in the evening and just all day, clear up until the time, July 13th to, it was March 2nd. Okay. So February, it was Valentine's Day of 2001. We were having the, trial for this guy. I was a witness for the state. And the DA said, Marla, we have this guy. We think that's him. And we just need you to identify him. Don't you know we're in the courtroom and that judge orders the bailiff to bring this guy in? So they open that the hatch where the criminals come in. Don't you know he looked at me that same way that he did whenever he pulled the gun on me? And I knew right then, that's him. I said, that's him. And he goes, you know, Marla, that's what we've been telling you. We know it's him. And I said, no, but that's him. He looked at me that same way. And he said, we got him. Don't worry. We got him. Sure enough. That next morning, February 15th, I was getting ready for work. This was a turning point. So all that time from that July clear up till February 14th, clear up to that morning of February 15th, I was getting ready for work. And I was looked at myself in the mirror and I heard myself ask in the mirror, who are you? And I took a step back and I was like, oh no, I can't do this anymore. I've lost myself. How could that be? I've tried to do everything I could to get back to me, but I lost myself. And whenever I saw myself ask that in the mirror, and it just scared me. I said, you know what? I've got to resign. I have to resign and get back to who I am, because my personal well-being is more important than any amount of money. And so I, of course, naturally went to work, typed up my resignation. And I said, you know, I said, boss, I'm sorry, but I have to go back home. I can't do this anymore. I've tried. And he goes, Marla, we have all kind of counseling resources. We have, you know, anything that you need, we can provide. And I said, I hear you. I said, but what I've lost, I don't think you guys can provide. What I've lost is my spirit. What I've lost is my culture. What I've lost mm-hmm. is that thing that connects me mm-hmm. to who I am and what I am. And so he goes, you know, Marla, he goes, I just want you to know, I understand you and I respect you. And please know the door is always open whenever you want to come back. And I said, you know what? I appreciate that. So they allowed me to go home, you know, and it was this mutual understanding that I needed to do what I had to do for my own personal well-being. And from that point on, it was just like, wow. I mean, you know, you never think about things and how, you know, it's always like this scared little girl. But what was crazy was during that time, from that July to February, I would have dreams of getting shot, like on the side, kind of like in my gut area, and I would wake up and I would just be holding my side like, oh man. And it would be like this warm, like blood was rushing out. But I have no idea what it's like to even be shot. I've never been shot before. But for someone who was having dreams of this and playing it out and waking up and I'm holding my side, and I thought, whoa, this is too much, you know?
So is that when the music started calling you back? Is that the point?
What happened was, yes. So I went back home, and outside of Cache is the Wichita Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time out there. I was taking pictures and just really trying to, that's where I was singing a lot, mm-hmm. Just to kind of get me, I would go out there early in the morning and just go hike different places.
Sure.
And just sing. Yeah. And really just sing. But what happened? I'm really thankful, actually, that event happened, because it helped me to see the beauty in things, and it helped me to appreciate who I am and where I come from. Because before, I'm not saying that I was just, you know, running amok. It was just that, you know, most people don't think about who they are and where they come from. They're just kind of going through the motions. But once they get to that point, you know, realizing who you are and where you come from and what the purpose is supposed to be in this world, what can I contribute that's going to be a positive positivity in this world? You know, it was singing these Comanche hymns. And so I really started to, it helped to calm me. It helped me to, it uplifted me. There are songs that have this beat where you are uplifted.
Mm-hmm.
And there are songs that are a little bit mellow that will kind of just soothe you down, calm you down.
Yes.
You know, and then there's songs that are just, man, I like the beat of that song, or I like the tempo. And you're just like, you know, just kind of getting after it. And but that was once I started to kind of feel that coming back, and I was like, all right, I'm getting myself back. That's great, because I want to be renewed, but with an understanding more so of who I am and where I come from. And I mean, I've always thought where I come from was beautiful, but I saw everything from a different lens. And that's what this event, even though it was traumatic, even though it was life-changing, it was for the better. And a lot of people, you know, we never know what stories, what trials and tribulations people are going through, but a majority of us can mask it pretty well, you know?
So what do you think about, like, do you feel like that, like, I don't know about you, but I feel like that my women, my female ancestors, I feel like that a lot of that blood is flowing through my veins. And I feel like that it gives me strength.
Absolutely.
Do you feel the same way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I come from a line of strong Indian women on both sides, both my mom's side and my dad's side. What was also during this learning process for what my cultural, where I come from and all of that, I can remember, like, my Seneca grandma, she would read to me every night. You know, she would set me aside and we would read stories. And with my grandpa, her husband, he was a preacher. They were like Nazarene missionaries. And so I grew up in different parts of the United States.
Sure.
Like whether they were living out in Tucson or if they were living up in Michigan with my Huron Band Potawatomi people. It was just really a unique upbringing that I had. And as I get older, the more and more that I appreciate it of coming from these strong indigenous women, like my mom and my grandmas. And there is no other, I'm so thankful that I was raised the way that I, but it was very different, you know, because as an adult, you know, you look at where you're going, where you've come from, but where you're going. And always, you know, kind of thinking back, like, wow, how was my mom at this time? How was my grandma during this time of her age and her life? You know, because right now I'm 46, and I always think about the things that they were doing when they were in their 40s. You know, was it, you know, taking care of, were we moving across the country?
Right.
Were we moving, you know, it, you never know. But those types of things are what I always think about, especially whenever I kind of hit those major points, you know, whenever I hit 30 and 35. And
sure.
40.
Sure.
My mom, she was 46 when she passed away. And I can remember when she was 41, having her open heart surgery and to replace a valve. And she said, baby, I'm not going to live much longer than, you know. And I said, Mom, it's okay. We're here for you. Whatever we need to have done.
Right.
You know, it's going to be all right. We're going to be okay. And so thankfully, you know, it was during Thanksgiving. It was the day after Thanksgiving in 2004 that she went on. And from me finding her in her room and really just kind of setting things in motion. I mean, she did the best job that she could to prepare us. But what's crazy is you never know about that preparation until that time comes. And even still, no one can prepare you.
No.
They can try their best, but in all honesty, no one can prepare you for those moments.
Yeah.
And so since 2004, you know, she's been gone. And but this time of the year is always a very special time because it was, you know, understanding that, Mom, you've done a great job raising a strong Native woman.
Yeah.
You've done the best job that, I mean, there's nothing that I would change about my growing up. And it was one of those things that even though my parents eventually, you know, they divorced whenever I was 15, even though they divorced, they still had that unique relationship that you could see, people could feel whenever we were all, I mean, we would all be at the same functions. And whether it be Christmas or birthdays, you know, everyone was still all together, which is very unique. Not a lot of people can do that, you know, but I was just really blessed to be and come from strong family cultural ties. And that
But what do you want? What do you want our audience to know about what it means to be a Native American Indigenous woman in the year 2022? What do you want them to know about that?
So I think as I get older, what I would like to see more of our kids embrace is their culture, mm-hmm. and understanding their culture more, because I really feel like it's our culture that grounds us and keeps us grounded in a time of such uncertainty. But yeah. I know that the leadership, you know, tries to do the best that they can for the future generations. But like for me growing up, education was always pushed, you mm-hmm. know, and I, you know, not, I would say in the past few years, you know, I've been thinking more about why was education pushed, which I mean, I think that's a great thing. I have my bachelor's and master's from, you know, mm-hmm. from OU. And I'm all about education.
Right. Me too.
But what I think that maybe what should have also been said is culture, keep your yeah. culture alive. Yeah. And whatever ways that is, I mean, so I'm a recording artist and I sing these Manchi hymns. And the reason why I sing them is to help bridge the gap. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we have to do certain things so that we can contribute in some way to the future generations, whether it's, you know, like these songs, people may only hear them. I can remember in 2004 when I came out with my first album, people would say, oh, that song reminds me of when my grandma, she would be cleaning in the kitchen or, you know, cleaning the house.
Right.
And she would just be singing. And, you know, but you see these adults, people that were older than me, but it brought them back to memory lane yeah. when they were stay yeah. at their grandma's.
Music
special
does that.
Times,
yeah.
special times yeah. of them growing up. And I was like, wow, you know, because you never realize the impact, right? I was like, well, I was just singing a song. And they said, no, that song right there, my grandma, she would sing it every time that she was cleaning or cooking. And I was like, wow, that's great. Well, that was in 2004. And at that time, we had probably, I would say, a little over more than two handfuls of Comanche hymn singers. Well, then in 2010, I came out with my second album, Comanche Hymns 2. And at that time, it might have dwindled down to just a little over one handful of singers in the community. And I was like, oh no, we're losing our singers more at a greater rate than what I thought.
Right.
You know, I was
right.
hoping this would help contribute
yeah.
to the younger generations and yeah. for them to kind of say, hey, I want to be a singer too, you yeah. know, but I never know of what that impact that you're going to have, you know, just kind of do what you can and try to hope for the best. Right.
Right.
And so, it was last summer. Okay. So COVID hits in 2020, and last summer I went to a funeral back home in our home community, one of the communities, and no Comanche hymn was even asked.
Wow.
There was no singers. Mm-hmm. And so I was stunned. I was stunned because it was like, oh no, is it because I'm not here in the community?
Yeah.
Am I on the road too much?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then it starts to become that type of thought process.
Sure.
Because what I thought was, if I just put these albums out, people are going to listen to it and they won't just think of funerals. Like, they won't just think of, you know, because like a lot of times now, people will say, the only time I hear Comanche hymns is at a funeral. And I'm
uh-huh.
like, what? That,
yeah.
That's not the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
Our
exactly.
songs are a natural part of our culture. Like,
sure.
on a daily basis or on a weekly basis throughout, it goes generations back, you know, and these have been passed down through the generations. And it was just like this, you know, what could I do different? Or what, you know, those type of questions started coming to me.
Yeah.
Because, and so thankfully, you know, like my brother, I have two younger brothers, the youngest one, well, both of them actually, they are singers as well. And it really have stepped up as far as in mm-hmm. the community, especially since the passing of our father, which was in October 2018. After the passing of him, there was real transition, just with me and my brothers. I was like, man, you know, this was our song leader in our community.
Yeah.
That, you know,
yeah.
We have to step up. This is our time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was so neat to see my brothers really embrace that and embrace who they are and where we come from. But just for me being an older sister and seeing my little brothers become the good men that they are. I mean, they have huge hearts and just am so proud of my brothers, and just to see them flourish and grow and just become better human beings. It's just like, wow, that is so cute. You know? But
no, again, that's awesome.
It stems back to our mother though.
Yes.
Our mother. It stems back to her because my brothers have that spirit of our mother in them. And that is it all comes back to our mom and our mom and our grandmas.
Marla, it has been so good to have you on, and we just have just a little bit of time left, but I'm going to give you this parting shot. One last thing. Yeah. Do you want to say?
Well, I just want to say thank you for having me. And I just want to say that, you know, every day we come from praying people, and every day we're praying for everybody. You know, it's not just our own, but it's for everybody. And I pray that everyone embraces who they are and where they come from, no matter what age, and continue to make your family proud.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Y'all, my guest has been Marla Nonai. I said it correctly.
Yes.
And I've been so blessed to have you on and talk to you and get to know you. And someday, hopefully you'll come back, but welcome. And just so glad that you came to Bloodlines and to talk about your story, which is amazing. And I just wish you all the very best.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.